sermons, and you'll see an entry here for lesson 218 for November 26. If you click that, you can then load up the notes that we will be following for this particular lesson. So, you should have in front of you then a set of notes for lesson 218, the AV 1611, Examining the Marginal Notes. Now, I did retitle this a little bit, okay, just to give a little bit more information. It was pretty generic when I just had other notes of interest, so I put in three things to try to at least give people some idea of what we're going to be covering. So I had an LXX, which is short for the Septuagint, unicorns, and Psalm 12:7. So unicorns should have been enough to maybe say, hey, what's this about? But we'll see what happens, okay? So let's get right into the introduction here. Again, this is lesson 218, Examining the Marginal Notes, and we're looking at other notes of interest, LXX, unicorns, and Psalm 12:7, assuming we get that far, okay? So, introduction. Since lesson 212, we've been examining the marginal notes found in the AV of 1611. Thus far, we have considered all of the following topics. Lesson 212, we looked at the different types of notes that are in the 1611. Lesson 213, we looked at political and partisan notes in the 1611 and how they dealt with those issues, knowing that King James did not like the marginal notes in the Geneva Bible because he felt them to be undermining of his authority as a king, as well as how they dealt with some of the more overtly theological notes that were in the Geneva Bible. So that was lesson 213. Excuse me, lesson 214. We looked at complete and partial verse rewrites. Lessons 215, 16, and 17, we looked at textual variants and alternative textual readings, and we ended up having that in three different parts, which then brings us to lesson 218, which is this morning, okay? In lesson 214, we laid out a list of topics that I intended to cover with respect to the marginal notes found in the 1611. Only one item from the list remains outstanding at this point, the category of, quote, other notes of interest. For this category, we are looking at miscellaneous marginalia addressing topics related to the defense of the King James Bible that often come up in public discussions. All told, we will consider the following points, okay? We're going to look at Septuagint references, which is why I have the LXX in the title. We're going to look at animals and beasts that are discussed in the biblical text. We're going to look at Psalm 12:7, and then we will eventually look at the note on Lucifer in Isaiah 14, verse 12, okay? Now, that's kind of where we're going here. So let's get right into the first point, which is Septuagint references, right? So, there are at least two direct references to the Septuagint in the marginalia of the New Testament in the 1611. Now, the Septuagint is the translation of the 70. It's often referred to shorthand as LXX. If you see the LXX reference, it is referring to the Septuagint, which is rumored or allegedly came into existence by locking 70 people in different rooms to translate the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek. And if you read the stories related to this, they all come out having exactly the same translations after a certain amount of time, and they're completely identical to each other, and so on. So obviously that's a little bit far-fetched, and I do not believe the legendary stories related to the creation of the LXX, okay? Now, that said, that there is a document that is claiming to be the LXX is, obviously, you could go to the Christian bookstore, go online and buy a copy of the Septuagint. So the idea of the Septuagint and the fact of it being a BC Septuagint is often a point of discussion amongst King James advocates. Peter Ruckman has a chapter in his book, The Christian Handbook on Manuscript Evidence, where he talks about what he calls the mythological LXX, saying that the LXX doesn't exist. I've read Ruckman's chapter many times. It is unclear to me if he's simply saying that the legend of how the Septuagint was created is a myth, or if the whole idea of a document existing is a myth. My personal opinion on the matter, which I've talked about in detail in other videos and other places, is that at some point The Hebrew Old Testament was translated into Greek. The idea, though, that it is before the time of Christ, I am unconvinced on that point. I suspect that it was later than that, after the writing of some of the New Testament documents. And I explained my thinking on that in some other videos. If we get into all that here, we won't make any progress. Okay. So, the reason I'm saying all that is the idea of the LXX being referenced by the King James translators could be a point of controversy for some King James advocates who do not believe such a document existed. The problem with that is, obviously, the translators mention it. So, and let me be clear what I'm saying here. There are two mentions in the New Testament. There are no mentions of it, as far as I can gather, in the Old Testament, and I have not checked the Apocrypha. There could be some LXX mentions in the Apocrypha, but there are only two, to my knowledge, in the canonical text, as far as marginal notes go, in the 1611. Okay? So, both of these occurrences happen to be in Acts chapter 13. So, go to the next page. Okay? So, the first one is in Acts chapter 13, verse 18. And you can see right here in verse 18, there is a dagger at the word suffered. And then if you go to the margin, it's going to give you some information about that. Okay? So in the margin at Acts 13, 18, there are some Greek characters here that I'm just going to be honest, they're hard for me to discern exactly what they are just because of the way the printing is here. So I just simply put in brackets their Greek characters. It was very hard for me to read that and discern what exactly was going on there. So if somebody else can help me out with that so I can supply that, that would certainly be appreciated. I struggled with making out specifically what all the characters were when I looked at it myself. Okay, but there's a dagger here which takes you to the margin, and then there is a note that says, a nurse breatheth, so this is on suffered, okay? So maybe we should read the verse. About that time of 40 years, suffered their manners in the wilderness, is the statement there. And this is from Paul's sermon in Acts 13. So you go to the margin, it says, as a nurse breatheth or feedeth her child, Deuteronomy 1:31 and 2 Maccabees 7:27, according to the Septuagint. So that abbreviation there, S-E-P-T, period, is short for Septuagint. So they're specifically referencing the Septuagint in the marginal note at Acts 13, 18, and so Christosom. So there's a church father that they're also mentioning here, okay? So there is a very clear, at Acts 13, verse 18, marginal note in the 1611 that is referencing the LXX, okay? There's a second one in the same chapter at verse 34. Okay? Verse 34. You can see it right here. Let me make sure I get it right. There's a dagger in verse 34 again. Where'd it go? Right here. At Mercies of David, which then takes you to the margin, and there is a fairly lengthy entry here. So let's read that off the notes. Again, there are some Greek characters there that were hard for me to figure out what they were exactly, just because they're difficult to read in the way that it's printed there. So again, if somebody out there in Cyberland could help me with that, I would certainly supply that. But for now, there's just a bracket that says Greek characters. Okay, so Mercies of David, you go to the margin and it says Greek, holy or just things, which word this Septuagint, both in the place of Isaiah 55:3 and in many other places, used for that which is in Hebrew, mercies. Okay? So on the surface, these just seem to be explaining or giving examples of the word usages between Greek and Hebrew. So let's look at my statement, next statement. On the surface, these two notes in Acts 13 pointing to the LXX would seem to be appealing to the Greek words used there as a guide to proper understanding of their use in Acts 13. So in other words, their elaboration on what the Greek word means, okay, seems to me to be what they are. The notes in question concerning the LXX are not intended to give any scriptural authority to the LXX, but merely used as a Koine Greek source to aid in the proper understanding slash interpretation of a particular Greek words as used in the New Testament. So they simply seem to me to be explanatory and helpful in nature, not saying or granting some sort of authority to the LXX in that regard. So, look at the next point. The fact that there are not more direct references to the LXX by the King James translators underscores the following point. With marginal notes such as those found in Acts 13, the translators are acknowledging that the Septuagint existed, but since they never actually follow it exclusively, they are not recognizing it as authoritative. These observations dovetail nicely with what Miles Smith said about the LXX in the preface to the 1611. Now, I've given you the full text here, but I've bolded a couple points of note that I want to point out. I'm not going to read all this. We already went through all this when we went through the preface. So let's just give attention now to the bolded sections, okay? So referring to the Septuagint, Miles Smith says, starting at the first bolded line, so I've given you the whole context, but for the sake of time and the teaching of the lesson, I'm just going to read the bolded. He says, it is certain that the translation, referring to the LXX, was not so sound and so perfect, but it needed in many places what? So is he saying that, did they believe, did the translators believe that it was perfect?
No.
No. They believed that it was, had some mistakes in it, it was not so sound and so perfect, and in some places needed correction. Again, for the sake of time, dropping down to the next bullet section, notice that the 70 were interpreters. They were not prophets. Now, why is that important? Why is it an important distinction to say that the 70, they're responsible for the Septuagint, are interpreters, not prophets? If they were prophets, were they speaking with the authority of God Himself? So in their translation work, they are doing some interpretive things. So Miles Smith, author of the preface, says that the 70 were interpreters, they were not prophets. They did many things well as learned men, but yet as men they stumbled and fell, while through oversight, another while through ignorance, yea, sometimes in many, to be noted to add to the original and sometimes to take from it. So, clearly, as Miles Smith saying, on any manner, he's not saying they were perfect. He's not saying they were prophets. He's not saying that they spoke, by inspiration of God as the prophet Isaiah or Jeremiah or Daniel did, and that they clearly were instances for which they made mistakes in their translation. Then the last bolded statement there in this first quote, this may suffice touching the Greek translations of the Old Testament. So, clearly they looked at it, they acknowledged it, they used it in their marginal notes in two places in Acts 13, but they're not saying that it's authoritative, they're simply acknowledging that, and I think the reason they're doing that is to give the reader explanation of the Greek words that are used in those places. And then there's a second quote here from the preface, where Miles Smith is talking about the LXX, and he says, the translation of the 70 dissenteth from the original in many places, neither doth it come near for
perspicuity,
gravity, majesty. So they're acknowledging it as a source, but are they giving it ultimate authority? No. Okay? So, top page 4. Despite some King James only talking points that the LXX is, quote, mythological, the King James translators acknowledged the existence of the LXX, but did not hold it in higher regard than the preserved Hebrew text. So, what do they view as more authoritative? The Hebrew or the Greek translation of the Hebrew? the Hebrew. Look at the next statement. In subsection 13 of the preface, Miles Smith stated the following. If you ask what they had before them, truly it were the Hebrew text of the Old Testament, the Greek of the New. These are the two golden pipes, or rather conduits, through which the olive branches empty themselves into gold. So clearly, what did they view as the authoritative text? The LXX, which is a Greek translation of the Hebrew, or the Hebrew that they had, the Hebrew text itself? It's a clear statement that they viewed the Hebrew text as what? Authoritative. Okay? So, yes, there are two instances in Acts 13 where they mention the Septuagint. That is an important point that cannot be escaped. It might be an inconvenient point for some on the pro-King James, for King James defense, just because of the way some things have been sort of stated in the past. But in doing it, they're not saying that the LXX is more authoritative than the Hebrew text. Now, in our day, scholars will say that every time the New Testament quotes from the Old Testament, that they're quoting the Septuagint. Okay? It's pretty clear to me that the translators did not believe that. Okay? So, any questions before we move on? So just to be clear, the LXX does exist as a historical document. It's my personal belief and conviction that it did not exist until much later than what modern scholars want to say. They want to say it's a BC Septuagint. I'm not convinced that that's true. Personally, for my own study of the issues, and again, maybe I should add links to this section. We write that down to where people can find more information about what I've said about that in other places, okay? So, any questions before we move on to animals and beasts? Mike, were you good with all that?
Yeah.
Good.
I looked at Wikipedia. You know, it's always, they're not always 100% accurate, but they have a lot of people inputting, and it says presumably translated in the 2nd century. Presumably. So
yeah.
They're not saying one way or the other.
So even they're acknowledging a certain amount of doubt. Okay? So again, what Ruckman believed about a mythological LXX, it's still unclear to me even to this day. Is he saying he does not believe the... Listen, I don't believe that they took 70 guys, locked them in a room, and they all came out after X number of days with absolutely identical translations. That's absurd. That didn't happen. I don't believe that. If that's what he means by a myth, okay. If he means by a myth that it doesn't exist, well, that would put him at odds with the King James translators, because do they say in their marginal notes and specifically reference the Septuagint? Okay, so we need to, I think, have more of a middle of the road sort of opinion about that. All right, so animals and beasts. In the preface to the 1611, while discussing the purpose and function of the marginal notes, Miles Smith mentioned rare beasts specifically. Quote, "There be many words in Scripture which be never found but once, having neither brother or neighbor, as the Hebrews speak, so that we cannot be holpen by a conference of places." So in other words, are there certain words that only occur one time? Holpen is an old word for helped. So if they only occur once, can you look at other occurrences for help on what they mean? You can't, because they only occur how many times? Once, okay? Again, now watch what he says next. "Again, there be many rare names of certain birds, beasts, and precious stones, etc., concerning the Hebrews themselves are so divided among themselves for judgment. And they may seem to have defined this or that rather because they would say something than because they were sure of that which they said." So in other words, are there places, according to Miles Smith, where even the Hebrews themselves doubt what certain things are specifically referring to? Okay? So they have to say something, and he's like, well, they had to say something, so we're going to You know, so that these are places then where they view the margin as an appropriate way to offer further explanation of some of these. Okay. Now, this section, we're going to look at three of these. We're going to look at unicorns, behemoth, and leviathan. Unicorns, behemoth, and leviathan. So there is a marginal note. Look at unicorns first. There's a marginal note at Isaiah 34, verse 7. Okay? So it says that the unicorns shall come. Okay? Now notice the double vertical lines, and you come over here to the margin, and what do they have in the margin? Rhinoceros. So people will make fun of the King James Bible for using the word unicorn. They will say, these stupid translators, they're putting in these mythical beasts with wings and one horn that look like a horse, and these have never been proven to exist. You know, these crazy translators, why would they do this? This proves the King James Bible is an inferior book. That's what they'll say, okay? The problem with that is, when you look at a marginal note like this, are they telling you what the way they understood what a unicorn was? They're saying that a switch would be to say what? Rhinoceros. Okay? Now, let's look at the next point. A form of the word unicorn occurs 9 times in 9 verses in the AV. Of these occurrences, only once in Isaiah 34:7 is there a marginal note appended to the verse. Okay? Go to the next page. Lexicographical resources dating to the 15th century define a unicorn as a rhinoceros. Consider the following furnished by the lexicons of early modern English. Okay? So the first entry is from 1480. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the title of this. Medulla Grammatis, I guess is how you would say it. But notice what it says. It has an entry for a rhinoceros, and it explicitly says it's a what?
Unicorn.
Unicorn. And what's the date on this? 1480. So is this 150 years roughly before the King James Bible? So a rhinoceros is equal to a unicorn according to a source from 1480. Does everybody see that? Look at the next one, 1483. Catholicon Evangelicum, the remedy for all diseases, which is a weird title, but notice there's an entry here for a unicorn. And then notice, this is Latin, but notice what word is this?
Rhinoceros.
So again, is there a connection in 1483 between a unicorn and a rhinoceros?
Yeah.
Yes. So when they say unicorn in Isaiah, in the note in Isaiah 34, and then they say or rhinoceros, are they? Does it seem to you like they're using a established English synonym?
Yes.
Go on. 1499. Promontorium. Parvarolum. I don't know. Notice, unicorn, beast, defined as what?
Rhinoceros.
So we have three sources going all the way back into the 15th century, 1480, 1483, 1499, that are clearly connecting a unicorn with what?
Rhinoceros.
Okay? Now, the Oxford English Dictionary, OED, possesses the following definition in its noun entry for unicorn. So let's look at this. Okay? Notice, used in Middle English versions of the Old Testament to render the Vulgate, unicornis, or what?
Rhinoceros.
And then it gives the Greek word. As translated of the Hebrew, rem, also, and retained in various later versions, but translated by wild ox in the Revised Bible. Okay? So, notice a few things about this definition. First, notice that it's used in Middle English, Old Testament, translated in the Vulgate, the connection between unicornis and rhinoceros, as translations of the Hebrew. Okay? So, the three that we just looked at here, and again, apologize for my voice, 1480, 1483, and 1499 Do all of those count as Middle English? The answer is what? Yes. Okay, they all count as Middle English. Okay, and then notice something here. Let's go to. So we're still at the OED. Notice 1382, which would be Wycliffe's Bible, whose strength is like two and what?
Unicorn.
So is Wycliffe using the word unicorn when he translates the Latin? Yep. And it's referring to, at the time, what animal? A mythological animal with a white mythological animal that looks like a horse with wings and a horn, or a rhinoceros? Okay. The Middle English Dictionary, MED, maintained by the University of Michigan, offers the following as one of its definitions for unicorn. Quote, a fabulous single-horned animal to which was generally attributed a fierce disposition and certain magical abilities, any one-horned or apparently one-horned animal, especially the what? The rhinoceros. Okay? So, could it refer to, even today, can it refer to a mythological animal?
Yeah.
Yeah? Well, could it refer to an animal we all know very much about, a rhinoceros?
Yeah.
Okay? The MED then provides a word usage example from Wycliffe's Bible. Here it is. 1382. Wycliffe Bible. I'll try to make this out. Something Lord God help laid him out of Egypt, whose strength was like unto a what?
Mm-hmm.
Unicorn. Read unicorn, Latin what?
Mm-hmm.
Rhinoceros. So Wycliffe is translating out of Latin. The word is rhinoceros. And so he translates it into Middle English as what? Unicorn. Okay? So, when the King James translators use the word unicorn, they were referring to a rhinoceros, not a what? Mythological creature. When you look at the occurrences of rhinoceros in that, I think will fit very nicely. Any questions about unicorns? Okay, the next one is behemoth. This is Job 40, verse 15. Job 40, verse 15. Okay? Behold now behemoth, which I made with thee. He eateth grass as what? An ox. So there's a simile there. Whatever a behemoth is, eats grass like what? An ox, according to what the verse says. So the word behemoth occurs only once in the text of the AV in Job 40, verse 15. So does this fit with the kind of example that Miles Smith gave in the preface for when a marginal note would be used? It's talking about a rare beast that's only mentioned what? Once, okay? English dictionaries are unclear as to what a behemoth is. The OED contains the following entry for behemoth. Notice what it says. An animal mentioned in the book of Job, probably the hippopotamus, but also used in later literature as a general expression for one of the largest and strongest animals. Okay? And then notice there's a figurative reference that is given there as well. And notice that it gives the verse that we're looking at here from Job 10. So here's Wycliffe Bible, behemoth, 1611 behemoth, I made thee. And notice it's giving Wycliffe here as the source. Okay, so that's from 1382. Now, the MED, Middle English Dictionary, contains an entry for the Middle English word behemoth. And this is what it says. Quote, any huge animal, an elephant, figuratively, who? The devil. So in Middle English, they're saying that a figurative meaning of behemoth could be what? The devil himself. Okay? Job 40, verse 15. It's numbered verse 15 in the Wycliffe Bible. In our Bible, it's verse 10 because it's just some differences in verse numbering. Okay? Job 40:15 in the Wycliffe Bible of the 1380s is cited by the MED as a word usage example of behemoth. Lo, behemoth, who I made with thee, shall as an ox eat hay. So again, you can see, is there a simile there?
Yeah.
Okay. So the use of behemoth in Job 40, verse 15, was standard in the English Bible prior to the AV of 1611. Wycliffe, Great Bible, Geneva Bible, Bishop's Bible, and Reams all read behemoth in Job 45, verse 15. The lone exception is the Coverdale Bible, which read cruel beast. Okay? Many modern King James advocates believe that behemoth is possibly a reference to dinosaurs, a word that was not used in English until 1842, according to the OED. So, I'm not necessarily taking a position on that, I'm just telling you what a lot of people have said. There's a marginal note here, it's not exactly helpful in my opinion as far as identifying exactly what it is, but it's there nonetheless, okay? But there are a lot of people who think that behemoth, so you think about, I don't know how much you know about or remember from a kid, and you know, kids are big into dinosaurs and stuff like this, but you know, you got quite a few of the dinosaurs that were at least believed to be omnivores, meaning they ate what? Grasses and plants, etc. So there are some that think this reference to behemoth is a reference to an herbivoric dinosaur, and thus the comparison to eat grass like what? An ox. Okay. And then we have Job 41, verse 1, Leviathan. Okay? Job 41, verse 1. So the verse says, canst thou draw out Leviathan with a hook? And you'll notice the double vertical lines. And Leviathan, you come over here to the margin here, and it says, that is a whale or a whirlpool. Okay? So the 1611 translators are offering whale as an alternative for what? Leviathan. Okay? The word Leviathan occurs 5 times in 4 verses in the AV. 2 of these occurrences had marginal notes appended to them in the 1611. Job 3:8 and Job 41:1. While not depicted above, the note at Job 3:8 reads, okay, let them curse it that curseth the day, who are ready to rise up, quote, their morning. Okay, now watch. Their morning, double vertical, where'd it go? Whoops, go. Their morning, double vertical lines, or what? Leviathan. Okay? So I'm seeing some faces. You're like, what? Okay. So, the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, contains 2 relevant definitions for Leviathan that need to be considered. Those are 1A and number 2. Please consider the following images. So here is 1A. Notice, it's pretty generic. The name of some aquatic animal, rare or imaginary, of enormous size, frequently mentioned in Hebrew poetry. And then it gives the Job 41 reference from the Wycliffe Bible as an example of that. Does everybody see that? Number 2. After Isaiah 27:1, so here's another one, the great enemy of God, Satan. So is there a dictionary entry that identifies Leviathan with Satan?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Notice, so let's all grab your Bible and go there. We want Isaiah 27:1. Okay. I guess I have it there also in the notes, but you can follow along. So the OED records two meanings for the word, one related to an undesignated, quote, aquatic animal, real or imagined, of enormous size, and second, the enemy of God, Satan, based on Isaiah 27:1. Okay? And the verse says, in the day that the Lord with his sore and great sword shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent, even Leviathan, the crooked serpent, and he will slay the dragon that is where? In the sea. So the Lord is going to punish Leviathan in that day. The Lord, in his sore and great and strong sword, with his sore and great and strong sword, shall punish Leviathan, the crooked serpent, even Leviathan, okay, the dragon that is in the sea. All right? So the dictionary is saying that there are two meanings of Leviathan that would be relevant to this conversation. One is the one that's in Job, what is it, Job 41. The other one is the one that is in Isaiah 27, verse 1, where it is a clear reference to Satan. Now, other lexicographical resources furnish similar findings according to the lexicons of early modern English. Okay, so note the dates here. 1589, Bibliotheca Scholastica by John Ryder, but has an entry for the devil, Satan, Diabolos, okay, Belial, demon, what? Leviathan. So is he, in an entry in 1589, identifying the devil as Leviathan? Okay? 1656, Glossopropedia, a dictionary by Thomas Blunt. Leviathan, Hebrew, a great water serpent or a kind of whale. Sometimes it is taken for who? Okay. The devil. 1677, an English dictionary by Elisha Coles. Leviathan, a whale, or by some, a great water serpent, also who?
The devil.
The devil. So do we have lexicographical sources that are connecting Leviathan with Satan? Okay, everybody with me so far? Okay. Now, let's look at Isaiah 27, verse 1 again. Let's read it again. In the day, the Lord with his sore and great and strong sword shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent, even Leviathan, the crooked serpent, and will slay the dragon that is in the sea. Okay? So look at my notes now. Notice how Isaiah 27:1 clearly identifies Leviathan as, quote, the dragon that is where? In the sea. Revelation 12:9 and 22 make it clear that the dragon is a reference to who? Satan. Revelation 12:9, says, and the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and who?
Satan.
Which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. And then we have Revelation 20, verse 2. And he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him how long?
1,000 years.
Okay? Now let's go back to Job 41. Job 41, verse 1. Job 41, verse 1. Canst thou draw out Leviathan with an hook, or his tongue with a cord, okay, which thou lettest down? So is it talking about some creature that's in the sea? Have we already seen now other occurrences of Leviathan related to this concept? So look at my note. Clear cross-references establish that Leviathan in Isaiah 27:1 is a reference to Satan as reported in the OED. Moreover, since Leviathan clearly resides in the sea in Isaiah 27:1, there is no reason to think that Job 41 verse 1 is referring to anything other than Satan when it speaks of, quote, drawing out Leviathan with a hook, since Leviathan resides where?
In the sea.
So I don't see any reason to say that the Leviathan of Job 41 is something different than the Leviathan of Isaiah 27 verse 1. Now, The King James translators, obviously, when they looked at that, let me just scroll back up here for a second, they did not put those verses together, and they simply said, Leviathan, that is a whale. Okay? So they are not making the type of cross-reference exposition that I'm making here, but I think it's perfectly legitimate based upon all the relevant data and cross-references to say that Leviathan, any point Leviathan is mentioned, is a reference to Satan. Okay? Now, any questions before we move on? All right. Everybody go Psalm 12. Now, we've talked a lot previous in this class about Psalm 12, 6, and 7. These are two hotly debated verses in the preservation conversation. And so to have a marginal note here would be a major mistake on my part not to discuss it. Okay? So, Psalm 12, 6. Look at your Bible. The words of the Lord are pure words, as silver tried in a furnace of earth, purified seven times. Verse 7. Thou shalt keep them, O Lord. Thou shalt preserve them from this generation how long? So the way the verse reads in the text of the AV is that what is being preserved in verse 7? What's being preserved in verse 7 is the words of the Lord from verse what? 6. Okay? Modern version advocates and people critical to King James, they'll say no. What's being preserved in verse 7 are the people from verse 5. Look at verse 5. For the oppression of the poor, for the sighing of the needy. Now will I arise, saith the Lord, and I will set him in safety that puffeth at him. And so they're saying that they're saying that what's being preserved in verse 7 is the people in verse 5, and they'll retranslate or translate differently verse 7, and they'll say, thou shalt keep them, O Lord, thou shalt preserve us. Not preserve them, they'll say preserve us from this generation forever, thereby making verse 7 refer back up to verse 5 instead of the immediate antecedent of verse 6. Now, I have a whole booklet out there on the back table about this verse and this passage and why this is a significant event or a significant passage. But now, if we look at our notes, we'll see that the 1611, verse 7, thou shalt keep them, O Lord, thou shalt preserve them from this generation forever. Notice that you have a dagger here which says, send you to the margin at verse 7, and it says, Hebrew him. Okay? I, every one of them. Okay? Now here's what happens. People who are critical of the King James, they'll go and they'll say, see? The translators acknowledge that the Hebrew is masculine when they said him where? In the margin. Okay? Let's go to my note. This verse is hotly contested in debates regarding the doctrine of preservation. Many critical text modern version advocates maintain that this passage is teaching the preservation of the people in verse 5 and not the words of the Lord in verse 6. This argument is based upon a technicality of Hebrew grammar known as gender discordance. Proponents of this view point to the them in verse 7 is masculine in Hebrew, while the near antecedent, the words in verse 6, is feminine. So if you look in your Bible, look at verse 6, the words of the Lord is feminine in Hebrew. You go to verse 7, preserve them is masculine. And they'll say that is a gender disagreement because you have a feminine in verse 6 and a masculine in verse 7. Okay? So go back to your notes. This argument is advanced based upon a technicality of Hebrew grammar known as gender discordance. Proponents of this viewpoint to them in verse 7 is masculine in Hebrew, while the near antecedent, the words in verse 6, is feminine. Therefore, making them in verse 7 to be a reference to the word of the Lord in verse 6 would be a gender mismatch. So they're saying you have to have a match of gender between masculine and masculine, or feminine and what? Feminine. Okay? Thus, it is argued that should say, I think the promised preservation of verse 7 points to the poor and to the needy of verse 5 because they are both masculine in Hebrew. So if you go back to verse 6, for the oppression of the poor is masculine, for the sighing of the needy is masculine. So what they're saying is that what's being preserved in verse 7, because the pronoun is masculine, has to match verse 5 because those pronouns are masculine. It is not a reference to the words of the Lord being preserved in verse 6 because the words of the Lord is feminine and you have to have a gender match. Is everybody following the argument? I've taught on this again many other places, okay? Thus it is argued that promise preservation of verse 7 points to the poor and the needy of verse 5 because they are both masculine. I believe the view that Psalm 12, 6, and 7 is a reference to the people in verse 5 is an incorrect interpretation. We have already dealt with this issue at great length in lessons 31 and 32, as well as in our booklet, The Preservation of God's Word, a close look at Psalm 12, 6, and 7. Interested parties are encouraged to consult these resources for more information. So I'm not going to reteach the whole gender discordance argument at the moment, but go to the top of page 10. The marginal note appended to Psalm 12:7 in the 1611 is often used by those advancing gender arguments with respect to the passage, but the King James translators acknowledge that them is masculine in verse 7 by placing Hebrew him in the margin. This is often used to advance the notion that the King James translators agreed with them. So let me explain. Does the margin clearly identify the Hebrew in this case as being masculine and saying him?
Yeah.
Yes. So modern version advocates that are against this verse teaching preservation, they will go there and say, see, even the King James translators agree with us. My problem with that is, are they reading the whole note? What does the rest of the note say? Every one of what?
Them.
Them. So are they acknowledging, are they being honest and acknowledging that it is masculine by saying him?
Yeah.
But they don't believe, they did not believe that that was the correct translation because they doubled down on the margin and say every one of what? Them. Okay, read my next point. The translator's note at Psalm 12:7 acknowledges that the Hebrew word is technically masculine by placing the word him in the margin. That said, one needs to consider the contents of the entire note. Hebrew, him, I, which I take as a statement of like I.E., or in other words, right? I, every one of them. While acknowledging that the word rendered them in the text is technically masculine, the rest of the note connects verse 7 with verse 6 when it reads I, every one of them, instead of altering the text to teach the preservation of the people in verse 5. This proves that the King James translators judged the principle of near antecedent as taking precedent over agreement in gender. So, look, if you're going to say based on gender discordance that the pronoun in verse 7 has to match verse 5, you're skipping verse what? 6. What the King James translators seem to me to be acknowledging in their margin is that what takes precedent here is not gender agreement, but near antecedent. The nearest antecedent to verse 7 is the one in verse 6, which is the words of who? The Lord, not the poor and the needy of verse 5. So they are acknowledging that yes, it's masculine, but they're saying they believe the proper translation is every one of what? Them. The way they have it in the text. Okay, so let me go back to the notes. This proves that the King James translators judge the principle of near antecedent as taking precedent over agreement in gender. The translators included this note knowing if they did not, their translation would be challenged. So instead of undermining the King James reading in Psalm 12, when read properly, it supports it. This note does not undermine the translator's reading in Psalm 12:7. It supports what they did. They're acknowledging this is masculine by saying him in the margin, but then they're saying we believe this is the correct reading by saying them. Does everybody follow that? Amy, you with that or are you confused?
Go on.
What's that?
Go on.
Okay. Now, that's majorly important in this greater conversation. Moreover, next point. Moreover, Psalm 12, 6 and 7 have pronouns with different genders. But note that verses 6 and 7 have plural pronouns. Verse 6 has words. Is words plural?
Yes.
Yes. Verse 7 has them. Is them plural?
Yes.
Okay. Whereas verse 5 has singular pronouns at the end of the verse. Puffeth that him. So put another way. Verses 6 and 7 have a gender difference, but the right number, meaning the plurals what? Match. Okay, let me read it again. Put another way, verses 6 and 7 have a gender difference, but the right number, while verse 5 has the wrong what? Number. The point is that the text does not have strict pronoun conformance under any reading. So even if the critics want to say, well, this is not referring to the text because of gender discordance, well, not only do you have that issue, but you have difference in number in the pronouns too. So it doesn't matter how you solve this issue, are you going to have a pronoun problem? Yeah. Therefore, the marginal note at Psalm 12:7 does not undermine the preservationist reading of the passage. It supports it and communicates the King James translators viewed the main body of the text as the correct English reading. So was it their choice that it said preserve them, connecting it to the previous antecedent in verse 6? So what's being preserved in verse 7 is the words of the Lord in verse what? 6. They acknowledge the masculine in the margin, but then they say, i.e., every one of what? Them. So is that clearly their intended reading?
Yes.
The answer is yes. Okay? So again, the reason why that's important is because in every conversation about preservation, this passage comes up, and rightfully so. Because if you can say that this passage is not teaching the preservation of the words, have you taken away a very clear testimony of the Scriptures that it teaches preservation? Because it literally says, thou shalt keep them, O Lord, thou shalt what? Preserve them. The text is using the word what? Preserve. Thou shalt preserve them how long? From this generation forever. So, you can see how that verse is going to factor heavy in debates and discussions relative to the issue of preservation in the greater conversation regarding the King James Bible and so forth. Okay? So, does anybody have any questions or comments?
So, I see in the marginal notes there, they have Proverbs 30:5. In the marginal note.
Here?
Yes.
Yeah, that's on the previous verse, though. That note is with verse 6, not on verse 7.
Okay.
So let me show you. Don't take my word for it. Go on with your thought, though, while I call this up.
Well,
I know you were going somewhere with that.
Well, I looked it up, Proverbs 35. Every word of God is pure. He is a shield unto them that put their trust in him. So, being a shield to them sounds like protection of people. It doesn't say preservation in that verse, but I just wondered.
Come on. So, that cross-reference, so here's verse 6. The words of the Lord are pure words. Star or asterisk takes you to a whole series of cross references relative to the words of the Lord.
Okay.
Silver as silver tried in a furnace of earth purified 7 times. So because of the way they've listed this here, when I take a screenshot of verse 7, it included that. But that's the last verse of a whole series of things that they're trying to connect here with this cross-reference.
Okay?
The noted question again is this one here at verse 7. Where they're clearly acknowledging, okay, yeah, them is masculine, i.e. every one of them. So they're what they're doing is they're being honest and they're saying, okay, we acknowledge that that's masculine, but we think the text should say every one of them, which is clearly then a reference back up to verse 7, or verse 6, excuse me, where it says the words of what?
The Lord.
So in the King James Bible, in factoring in the marginal note as well, it's very clear to me that their intended reading was for it to say, thou shalt preserve them, not thou shalt preserve him or us. They are clearly thinking that the verse is teaching the preservation of the words, not the people, from verse 5. Okay? Now, Mike, you'd send me a couple things here. Was there anything you wanted to add?
Only that proper English would be referring to the previous sentence, them. I mean, they wouldn't skip and go back to the verse 5. I mean, nowhere else in the Bible does it do that.
And I will agree with that. And the other thing I will say is this. There are many examples in Psalm 119. You grab my little booklet or watch the videos on this or read the notes. In Psalm 119, the entirety of Psalm 119, almost every verse is about the Word of God. There's a handful of times in that passage where there is gender discordance in verses clearly referring to the Scriptures that are not corrected in modern versions. So the question is, why are they against it here in this passage, but they're okay with it in all the other ones? And I submit to you that the reason is because theologically, doctrinally, that verse is a problem for people who want to say, or the verse is a problem for people who want to deny the biblical promise of preservation. Because the verse, as it reads in the King James, is clearly saying that the words of verse 6 are preserved for this generation forever in verse 7. And if you're wanting to be adopting a reconstructionist approach to the text based upon reasoned eclecticism, like we talked about last week, that's going to be a problem for you theologically. So they're inconsistent when they take the same principle and it applies in other places. I showed examples of this in my booklet and in my previous teaching on this to you guys. Okay? So anybody got any questions or comments?
No questions. Now, since you said that, and you told me, I'm not that good in English, it's very obvious.
That it's referring to words?
Yeah.
If you just read the English in the King James, yes, it's very clear. So they have to come along then with Hebrew grammatical arguments to try to say, well, it should say this or it should say that or whatever. Okay. What I'm saying, just to be clear, did the translators acknowledge that it's masculine? Yep, but then they doubled down in the margin on why they did it the way they did it in the text. They thought that was the correct way to do it. Okay? All right. We got to quit. Thanks for your attention. And we will be back in this room next week.